What did you have for breakfast today?
This morning, I normally don't eat breakfast. I normally fast between 8 p.m. and midday every day.
Okay.
So I generally don't eat breakfast. This morning, however, I did have a breakfast meeting with a startup that I was helping through a rough patch.
Okay.
And I had crumpets from Cumulus Inc. and a flat white.
Wow. Delicious. Yeah. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Michaelides. In our podcast, we interview unique individuals and investigate interesting topics, helping you to build the uncommon sense crucial to increasing performance. Our guests have included a wide array of people, including venture capitalists, strength coaches, human rights advocates, chefs, bodybuilders, restaurateurs, and rappers, just to name a few. And you'll notice that our conversational style and line of questioning is very much inspired by the likes of Charlie Rose, Joe Rogan, Tim Ferriss, and Charlie Munger, who, as Warren Buffett's business partner, really emphasized the importance of building worldly wisdom to, I think, improve your growth as an individual. So that is very important to us, and you notice that through our style and our questioning. If you'd like to learn more, please head to neural.com/podcast. You'll see there we also have an index of all of our past episodes and the show notes included there. If you like this episode, make sure you leave us a review. We always appreciate your thoughts and feedback on that. 90% of our guests subscribe for priority access and our show notes. So perhaps you should consider that as well. Again, you can find the sign up page at neural.com/podcast. That is neurawle.com/podcast. Don't forget to like us on Facebook or Twitter. It's just at Neural on either platform. In this episode, we recorded with Matt Allen. Matt is a prominent developer, former entrepreneur, investor, and advisor within the Australian startup community, particularly here in Melbourne. He also works as a startup BD at Amazon Web Services. I think that Matt is a great example and proof of learning from mistakes through observation, knowing, much like Amazon's founder, the importance of being a great leader as opposed to a manager. And I think he's definitely one of the most balanced individuals I've met thus far in the startup community. He's always willing to give truthful advice as opposed to glazing it over or sugarcoating it for some individuals, always helping a multitude of founders and startups along the way. And Matt has personally given me countless pearls of wisdom over the years while cruising around in his Tesla. So I think you should really listen carefully and get your notebooks ready for those in business, entrepreneurship, or the startup game. I think in this episode, we covered things like going from corporate to startup land and vice versa, now that he's moved from the startup world to the corporate world at Amazon, getting interested in tech as a kid, the importance of work-life balance. And I think this is something he's covered a lot with founders, is founder burnout, and something that we've covered now a few times in previous episodes. Growth mentality and VC backing, management versus leadership, how he got into angel investing, how he'd start by teaching someone how to code, what it's like working at Amazon, validating product for a startup launch, and then lessons learned from founding his own companies along the way. So I think, like I said, there's going to be a lot of lessons here for those in the startup world, entrepreneurship and business. So make sure you get those notebooks ready. I think if you enjoyed this episode, or you do enjoy it, then you'd like our discussion with Scott Hansacker, Adrian Stone, or Nathan Sampimon. In each of these episodes, we covered similar topics around startups, tech, and VC. So we'll have links in the show notes. Otherwise, you can just head to neural.com/podcast. So without any further ceremony or ado, please enjoy this conversation with Matt Allen. All right, we're live. Matt Allen, thanks for joining. I'd like to give all of our guests a little brief bio on who who we're speaking to. I had a few little notes here. Grew up in suburban Sydney.
Yep.
Co-founder, Process Go, What Costs, a few other little startups in there. An omnipresent angel investor in the Melbourne startup scene, I'd say. I think I've seen you at nearly every event. So an angel investor as well. For a time, you were president and treasurer of the Ruby
yeah, Ruby Australia.
Ruby
yeah.
Australia. And obviously Look Ahead and now at AWS.
Yeah, that's me.
We were speaking before and I had that note about, you know, changing roles and so forth. How would someone, if they're a founder, if they're somewhat at a corporate environment, how would you suggest on making decisions to change roles?
I'd say it's always been a challenge for me. Most recently, I've gone the other way. I've just taken my first corporate role I've had since my very first job when I was 18, mm-hmm. Now at Amazon. But, yeah, changing and swapping has always been a challenge for me personally, mostly because the things I was involved in were smaller organizations, you know, fewer people, you know, always worried about the impact you'll have when you choose to do something new. For people that are inside corporates, you know, looking over the fence and seeing the nice green grass of startup land, I think that the challenge there quite often is the chaotic nature of having to do all the things and not having a large team around you to get other stuff done. That's one of the things I'm realizing now on the flip side of that conversation, which is, you know, I've got a job to do. It's relatively well-defined, mm-hmm. and there's a bunch of stuff that I don't have to do anymore, which is pleasant.
Yeah. So if someone was, let's say if you were going from that startup world into the corporate world, as we call it, how would someone make that decision? You know, like was there anything that really defined it for you, or is it dependent on the individual? Is there some sort of principles that people could use in any way to make a decision?
That's a tricky question. So I haven't co-founded a startup, a proper tech startup for four or so years now. My last 4 years has been in a tech recruiting company that I joined after when it was a year old and became a partner and ran the Melbourne team. Look, for me, it was a slightly different and very specific purpose, and that was, you know, was approached to join the startup team at Amazon in their AWS division. And that seemed to me came out of nowhere and was quite exciting. And one thing that I hadn't had in my entire career was a large, you know, well-known brand that I'd sort of seen from the inside.
Right.
So all my stuff had been small business or startups that I'd founded myself. So, you know, I'd spent a little bit of time in the States in the beginning of 2017 and you know, caught up with a couple of mates who were at Apple and Pinterest and, you know, doing amazingly well. These were people that had worked with me in the past and, in fact, had learned from me when I was, you know, being a software developer. And now they're leading tech teams at Pinterest and, you know, another mate is on the design team at Apple. And it's like that's – and listening to them talk about the things that they get to see on a daily basis – was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Completely different to, you know, being in a very small team or a very small startup.
Yeah. How did you first get into tech? What was the moment when you thought, I really like were you always into computers or software and stuff like that at a young age?
Yeah. Cool. Let's rewind back to the late 80s, and early 90s. My parents bought us a computer, you know, a PC back in the day, and I remember, you know, hounding them for it, and it was brutally expensive. I think it was $5,500 or $6,000, and that was a Mac LC575,
oh, wow.
And it was just, you know, my parents are not techies at all, but they bought us this computer, and you know, it it allowed me to do stuff outside of school that not many other people had the opportunity to do back then, including dialing up to the internet and getting on BBSs and doing lots of geeky stuff and trying to figure out, you know, how this whole thing worked. But interestingly enough, my parents were pretty liberal, but they were pretty consistent on not using the computer just to play games all the time. So I was able to say to my mum and dad, hey, look, if I use the computer to do something, you know, can I get more computer time? They're like, you can have unlimited time as long as you're not playing games. So I, you know, made music. I, you know, programmed, made, you know, little programs and just did stuff that was producing rather than consuming, which, you know, there wasn't a lot of material. This was buying magazines from the newsagent that had a CD on the front and shareware programs and running programs and trying to understand how they work. And it was... it was back when sort of the Mac and PC thing sort of first divided. So I had mates that had PCs and I had this Mac, and it was you know, frustrating sometimes. I couldn't play the games they played, but yeah, eventually we got a PC as well, or instead, can't remember. But yeah, just, you know, writing code and understanding, getting big textbooks full of, you know, how to write BASIC, and understanding the concepts of development, yeah, was, you know, the thing we did on afternoon after school back then.
It sounds like, and what you're saying about your parents then, how they sort of made sure that you would not just be sitting on the computer all the time, but also did other things as well. Like, I noticed that, and this is just, you know, going through Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff, it seems that you do, looking at your stuff, you have the ability to go out and do things. Like, you're out and about in terms of, I see a lot of photos, you know, you've obviously got your Tesla and you're going for your drives, which you love. But it seems that you have this ability to maybe smell the roses a bit, if I'd coin it that way.
Yeah. So
to just get out of that techiness and you know, because I was chatting to Nathan and one of the key issues he spoke about was founder burnout.
Yeah.
And I wonder if people realize that.
Yeah, and I burned out in my first startup. I absolutely hit a wall, and it was due to not having enough of that stuff. It was in 2005, where I literally ended up on the couch. It was 6 months after the birth of our first son, and my wife was forced to go back to work from maternity leave early because I could not get off the couch.
Really?
So yeah, it's still like, I still remember it vividly.
What happened? What, you just couldn't move?
Or? So we were 5 years into our startup. We borrowed a whole bunch of money off my co-founder's parents, you know, as capital in theory, but it was kind of a loan. And it just wasn't going where we needed it to go. You know, 5 years is a long time. I'd employed a couple of my mates. They came along and helped me build it. You know, they were developers as well. And it just wasn't. It was just one of those things where, you know, every time we thought we were going to succeed at the next level, it didn't quite get there. And there was a point in time, as I said, just after our eldest was born, where I just lost it. I just couldn't function anymore. And, you know, we were faced with a hard decision. You know, I walk away from this thing. We just brought on some new directors and they were sort of taking it to a new level, but there was a whole bunch of new pressure there and I just couldn't handle it. And it hurt. It hurt a lot. You know, there was a whole bunch of conversations with doctors and psychologists and shit to try and, like, work this stuff out. And I think it was just a culmination of 5 years of hard slogging, borrowed a shitload of money, had a new kid, our first kid. We were living in a one-bedroom apartment. I was working from home. It was just a tornado of startup crap that just took me out with it.
And what did you learn from that? Is there something that you took away?
Yeah, that it's easy to most of the time it's easy to keep going than actually zoom out a little bit and go, this is not gonna do what we thought it was gonna do. And you got co-founders, you've got investors, you've got people around where it's like, you know, there's a whole bunch of people relying on me, you know. A lot of the time it's ego wrapped up in there, you know, like what will these people think of me if this doesn't work? What will I think of me when this doesn't work? And you know, I had a discussion this morning at breakfast with another founder who was, you know, whose startup is probably going to wind up shortly. And he's like, you know, I've been at this thing for a long time and, you know, my ego is wrapped up in this thing. And I think that that's a really core component to this. And especially when you're in your first couple, one or two, like it's, you know, you it's very hard to pluck these things apart and understand the difference between business succeeding and you succeeding and learning stuff. You know, I think as soon as you've got investors in there, like it's, you know, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it sort of adds like an immense amount of fuel to the fire.
Yep.
And it just becomes, because you are really, I think when I spoke with Scott, he was just saying that they're depending on you, like with any business in the portfolio, to have an exceptionally big business.
Mm.
So everything you do is just, you know, so focused and so full on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I think it's becoming obvious to me now that a lot of people are venture funding businesses that shouldn't be venture funded. They are not venture fundable businesses. That's not to say that you shouldn't have investors. It's just got to make sure you get the right ones. Yeah. The expectations are aligned. And also taking sizable chunks of money from, you know, friends and family is a whole world of pain most of the time.
Yeah, I remember ages ago you had this tweet and I actually, banging that teapot around. I remember you had this brilliant tweet about how Silicon Valley, maybe it was last year, I wrote an article in Feb last year and I used your tweet as one of the examples around this topic, but how Silicon Valley was sort of re-gearing and focusing on revenue in the business. And it's like, oh, right, we actually have to have a business to survive. And it's so intriguing how that sort of growth mentality, and, you know, David Heinemann Hansen's written about it heaps. I'm intrigued to get your opinion on that.
So it's funny. I have two almost opposite views of the world, of which I sing from two different songbooks at any given point in time. So one is, if you're not building a venture-backed company, if you're not building a company that's going to be as big as VC money is going to get, is going to want you to get, then what you're really building is a business that, you know, should stand on its own two feet. And I'm seeing more and more companies that are like kind of bootstrap plus. It's kind of like, let's take a small round. Like a couple of my portfolio companies, let's take a small couple of $100,000 round, which will give a couple of co-founders, you know, a 12, 18-month runway, you know, depending on how frugal they can be. Mm-hmm. And that's enough time to sort of hopefully get a business up and running. On the other hand, you know, I work with some VCs and refer companies to them that are absolutely VC-backed companies. You know, I was listening to Nikki Schreck from Blackbird talk on a podcast last night from Growth Engineer. And you know, VC companies, they back things that there's a small chance of a very, very large thing happening.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of risk there, but when it happens, it's going to be big. Now, there's a lot of really interesting investable companies that, you know, can spew out good profits, you know, can run with good margins, and it can still be a global audience, but, you know, they may not turn out to be worth billions of dollars. And I'm not sure that most founders think what life is going to be like when all of a sudden you've got capital in there that is expecting a massive return.
Yeah.
So on one hand, if you've got something that's, you know, going to be super big but might be, you know, super risky, and if you can got a good team and you can execute on that, then that's definitely something that I will have conversations with those founders and refer them to my, you know, my friends who are VCs. Conversely, there's a bunch of things that those founders do not want to get on that, you know, don't want to strap that rocket ship on either now or at all. Maybe later, but for now, you know, maybe not, you know.
So if anyone really, in a way, people should be looking at VC money when they're in a position where they could probably service a market which is truly, truly big.
Yeah, I can't remember. I was racking my brain this morning trying to remember who said this, but VC money is like diesel. So if you pour a lot of diesel on a small fire, all you end up with is a bunch of smelly sticks. But if your fire is the right size, then it can really, you know, it can really make it grow. So
that's a brilliant analogy.
It's difficult to – sometimes it's difficult for a founder to be able to tell if their fire is big enough, you know, because everyone's very excited about their own little thing. But it's really quite your timing is kind of got to be a little bit impeccable here, you know, as to whether or not it smothers you or whether or not it makes you go big. And mostly that comes down to the founding and the founders and the founding team, you know, as to whether or not they're ready to, you know, focus exactly on what they need to do to use that capital wisely.
Yeah, and I'm always intrigued by this because a lot of the people I've had now who are VCs have spoken about how it's all about the founder.
Mm.
Is it really? I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to have some decent product.
I think it's obviously the product needs to be extremely useful to probably initially a small amount of people who it makes their, you know, it makes a painful part of their day go away. To get to the point where the founders, where the product has sort of proven that, then, you know, that's all just tenacity and grit, right? There's very, very few products that take off like a rocket without some kind of grind up front from some founders that hopefully know what they're doing, understand the space they're in.
Yeah. Do you, when you look at founders, is there any attributes, any particular skill sets or characteristics that you always look for?
For me, it's actually a lot of the time, and most of my portfolio companies have got deep experience with the domain. My portfolio is relatively focused on a few fintech things and a few developer tools. So, having been a software developer for 20 years, my space, the people that I connect with pretty regularly are people that work in software teams. There's a few of my portfolio companies that solve problems, specific problems for them. And the reason they solve those problems is because they were headbutting the problem on a daily basis inside a team and then came out of the team, built it. And then lo and behold, other teams, you know, have the same problem, which is, you know, not surprising.
Yeah.
Dev tools is an interesting space. It's kind of a hidden problem. There's not many, you know, normal people don't understand the problems that software teams have.
No.
I enjoy having those conversations. So tenets of the founders, experience in the domain, the desire to make it better, right? So that usually comes from experiencing the problem. And in my space, I'm just thinking here, every single one of my founders is solving a problem that they had. Luckily for me or them, they're software developers, so lots of people having these problems. And, you know, as of today, probably the fewest amount of people writing software ever is today, right? So, like, it's going to get more and more and more going forward. So, understanding that there's a growing market for people who are coding things up and going to all suffer similar problems is sort of where my vision goes for that kind of stuff. But on a founder level, experience with the problem, you know, wanting to improve it and actually sort of being able to articulate pretty early as to how they're going to do that.
Yeah. I want to go back to, there's a few things you mentioned there when you were chatting about the early days of your first computer, your parents and so forth. Do you think there's any lessons that you've carried through the years, particularly through work as well, that you've learnt from your parents, whether directly or indirectly, that maybe they said it,
Actually, been thinking about this a little bit lately. So my parents are the least entrepreneurial technical people you've ever met. My dad had one job for his entire career. He started at Sydney Water, or the Water Board as it was back then, when he was 17 and a half, and he retired when he was 57 and a half. He's been retired for 13 years and he had a few roles within there, but he did one thing. My mum was a stay-at-home mum most of the time, did a little bit of work, you know, as we grew older. I don't know how the hell I started running companies from I was 19 based on that. the one thing that I do, you know, remember and reflect on is that my parents weren't, they were never pushy. They never made me do anything. You know, they were always, you know, do what you need to do. I had two jobs. I got two jobs on my 15th birthday. One was at McDonald's and the other one was at a hobby shop that I worked on Saturdays. And I've had a job ever since, which is 25 years this year. And they were really supportive in that, you know, like they'd go out of their way to make sure that, you know, I could get to work basically. I remember, you know, Mum coming to pick me up at 1 a.m. in the morning in a pajamas from Macca's, me smelling like hamburgers, and that smell will never leave me. It's just disgusting.
I worked at Hungry Jack's when I at the same age, about 15. Pay was horrible.
Yeah,
smelled like shit. Lasted probably a few months, and then I realized that this is just not fucking worth it.
So you do remind me of nothing. So maybe moving on from lessons I learned from my parents. So you know nothing. Nothing except a grounding in, you know, them enabling me to get into computers and supporting me by, you know, spending a lot of money to get me one, and then allowing me to rack up huge phone bills as I dialed up to the internet. But moving on to, say, Macca's, I was there for 3 or 4 years, and I remember one of my managers was just the worst, and he was just... You know, when we were under the pump, when we had busloads of people coming, he just wouldn't help. He'd just stand there and bark orders. And, you know, there I was trying to construct Big Macs, you know, like a machine and running out of lettuce. And I'm like, hey, man, can you just grab – you're standing right there. Can you grab me some lettuce? I'm nearly out. And he's like, no, come and get it yourself, you know, as the bun's backing up. And I remember to this day, I'm like, I'm never going to be that guy. Like when my crew need me, like, I'm going to be there. You know, that's the kind of – hopefully the kind of thing I am, you know, and thinking about the times I've spent in my startups, like I would work hard and get this stuff done and try and be there for the people around me, you know, whether I'm their manager or not, is neither here nor there. It's like we got to get this shit done, so let's just get it done.
Yeah, I feel like there's a real – reading about these sort of topics and particularly leadership, and I feel like there's a very strong component of leadership that – the corporate world can learn from the military. And it's so obvious how leadership is earned, you know, versus management is just given. You see that so much in the corporate world. It'll be intriguing, you know, I don't think Amazon would be the type of place where you have to have that sort of issue, but it's just always fascinating how that sort of barking orders in large corporations perpetuates, you know.
Yeah, you know, I'm relatively new here at Amazon, but you know, the exposure to Jeff Bezos's, you know, annual shareholder letters and that stuff truly flows from the top. And I've experienced so far lots of people, lots of internal team just getting on with stuff and using those leadership principles that are well documented to get stuff done. And I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. Now, going back to angel investing. How the hell did you get into that? Because I feel like this has happened around the same time that you were getting involved in or running startups as well. What sort of came first?
Well, startups were first, the investing only started when I started my career as a recruiter when I switched over in 2013. They were actually unrelated. It actually just happened that I'd taken a pretty big punt on Xero floating on the Australian Stock Exchange. I was the first Xero certified Xero developer that wasn't a Kiwi. So really? Back when Xero was relatively small, I'd done a whole bunch of work on the platform, on the API. I built a couple of Xero add-ons, some for customers, some for me, did some integration work. So I was kind of really interested in and deeply involved in that side of things. I've always had a fascination with business and tech running into each other. And, you know, having run several companies, you know, since I was 18, and I almost put the ones that came post-Xero are the ones that succeeded and the ones that were not a complete pain in my ass to run, and the ones pre-Xero were just horrible. So personally, I enjoy using the platform as a customer and as a business person, but as a as a technology software developer consultant, I did a lot of work with that. So I took a pretty big punt, and with my wife's blessing, we dumped a whole bunch of our money into Xero on the stock exchange, and it went pretty well. It rallied really hard for quite a while, and then some angel investing opportunities came up, and I started selling that down to move into early stage startups. So yeah, that's how that happened.
Wow, that's fascinating. And so how did you go about starting to get into angel investments? Did you obviously already had your network here in Australia. What sort of came first? Was it pure introductions, or did you start reaching out to people and say, hey?
So although I've hung out with software developers, you know, most of my career, and, you know, through the Ruby community from 2006 and PHP and Linux and open source stuff before that, I'd started, if I was to be completely truthful, you know, a decade ago, drifting away from pure tech and up into business stuff. Like, I enjoy solving business problems, and tech was obviously the facilitator of that. And understanding how tech worked allowed me to think about business problems differently to other people and look at it from a systems perspective. And I can code that up and solve that problem. And that process, you know, is now disconnected and janky, and now it's fast and smooth. So, you know, tick, here we go. And I just started, a few of my developer mates had started companies. And I'm like, hey, are you guys raising any money? And they're like, yeah, well, we're thinking about it. I'm like, well, can I help? They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, can I put some money in? Can I talk to some other people that I know that have got, you know, again, just not super high net worth individuals. That's not my people. They're just people who, you know, can cut $10,000-$20,000 checks because, you know, they're interested in this space, and they're like, well, we don't really know who to talk to. So I kind of became a bridge for some people between I know these tech founders and I can see what they're doing and I can see where they're going to go with this, and hey, we're kind of interested in this thing, but we don't really know, you know, how to, we're not as connected as you are. So so the first couple were techies that were doing something and happened to be raising around that I already knew. So I knew them for a long time. I understood their product, understood where they're going. So that worked. And then there was a few that that I had been talking to, and they were, you know, pre-company. So they're like, I've got this idea, I've got this sort of side project. I'm like, well, if you want to start something, then let's do that. So then I can sort of help to raise those rounds, investing as well, but also, you know, forming companies and, you know, putting founders together and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And how do you feel that you developed that sort of bridge? Like, obviously you started your own companies. Do you think it's just purely that in one part you were developing tech, but on the other part you were having to learn to run a business and speak to customers and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think, I was remembering the other day that when I was young, I had this I met the guy who was like Greg Norman's IT guy. He was like the dude who travels the world and, you know, puts his in and just rocks up and gets things working for Greg Norman as he's on the golf tour, because I used to run a golf website. And I'm like, I just want to be that, like that guy who's like, you know, the IT sidekick to some rich guy. And and that obviously never happened. But what did happen was having conversations about technical challenging problems with non-technical people, it turns out that I can tell those technical stories pretty well. And that is good. And that's sort of about, you know, gaining trust in all my angel investment. You know, if I'm putting money in, then I'll go, well, if you're doing it, and then maybe that's a signal that maybe we should as well. And having to, you know, connect those dots and go, well, these guys are geeky over here, but trust me, I think they're good people. I can see their product. I've, you know, I know how they're doing it, how they're solving it on a technical level. You know, they're going to need some help with business. So we do a little bit of that and off we go.
Okay. I'm thinking back to what you said about your parents. They weren't exactly techies. I wonder if that plays a part in it. You know, that sort of crossroad of more liberal arts, more liberal life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And it's interesting thinking about us, my wife, April, and I, and our kids is like, you know, how do we do that? We try and encourage them to, you know, create instead of consume, although it's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Poorly. We have a pretty strict screen regime at home. Ever since they've been little, they don't use their screens from Sunday dinner time till Friday after school, unless it's for schoolwork,
right?
Or making something. I've got the same deal with them as my parents had with me. If you're coding, if you're making music, if you're creating anything rather than watching YouTube or playing a game. You can have as much computer time as you like. The eldest one doesn't take me up on it. The youngest one has only recently got a hand-me-down laptop and has been making music in GarageBand, you know, for the last couple of days, which is cool.
Really?
The flip side is if they're not on the computer, they'll be out playing with their mates. So, you know, either way, I'm happy that they're doing that.
Have you gone about trying to show them, you know, how to code or anything like that?
Yeah, a little bit. I took my youngest with me. I was judging a hackathon on the weekend. I took him there. So he went there. I think the best thing he took out of that was a whole bunch of stickers to put on his new laptop. But you know, immersion in this kind of thing, and he's done some code school stuff. So he's on the school holidays, he was writing some code. Show them. Yeah, look, I haven't had a side project for a little while. But yeah, I'm it's on my to-do list.
Well, so this intrigues me then. If you were to show someone, and in this case, we could assume your son. If you were to show someone the basics and what is fundamental, because, you know, obviously you were fairly involved in the Ruby community, what was fundamental to coding? How would you go about it to a beginner?
It's tough. Like learning to code is actually a byproduct of learning how to solve problems. I prefer to see them you know, asking questions and being curious and trying to understand a problem than actually learning how to code. So obviously we use code to build the solutions to problems that we've identified, is, you know, the way it works. And how you build that code, what code you write, you know, depends on the problem and the potential solution you've come up with. So it's, you know, you can sit down and you can do, there's all kinds of gamified ways to learn how to code, and, you know, and my boys have done, you know, Scratch and that kind of thing, where it's kind of a GUI on top of loops and variables and all the things you need to learn how to code.
Yeah.
But ultimately what I'd, you know, and I need some to see is have an engaging problem, something they're actually like, hey, I want to help you solve this problem.
Yeah.
So having them come to me and say, hey, I've got a problem. I'm like, cool, let's solve it.
Yeah.
You can't force that onto anybody.
I think that's a good point. I think sort of what you're doing now, it seems like you're just instilling that interest in this area, and then, you know, maybe a year from now, your younger son, he may have a problem, and then you go about it there. That's an intriguing way to think about it.
Yeah, you know, when I was at Look Ahead, I'd go and talk to the General Assembly classes, you know, go and talk to the GA classes and sit down with a new batch of 30 people that have just spent, you know, the last 3 months learning how to code Ruby and JavaScript and do web stuff, and, you know, your job is not to sit there and code all day long. Your job is to, you know, understand the problem and come up, you know, ask lots of questions to understand really what what the problem is we're trying to solve. And, you know, I talk to my founders about this all the time as well, is, you know, you fall in love with that problem, and it's like the problem, this is the problem. And you talk about the problem a lot, and sooner or later people go like, shut up about the problem, what are we going to do about it? At which point in time you've probably understood it enough and had enough people agree that it is a problem that you can start working on a solution. Like, I personally am to blame to write way too many solutions looking for a problem and cool code up something cool. Hey, look, I coded this cool thing. I'm like, yeah, okay, what's it do? You know, why is it doing that? I'm like, I don't know, I just was bored and wanted to write something.
Do you think, I'm intrigued then, how much of that has been a focus in your short time that you've been at Amazon? Because I know that Bezos, I love reading Bezos's Bezos and the Berkshire Hathaway annual letters, I love reading. And, just looking at little snippets and the entire picture of his recent, you know, shareholders meeting, I just love how they've always got that idea of having, they've always got an empty chair in the room. That whole mentality of, you know,
it's the always day one and the customer obsession. And that's it, right? It's how do we do stuff for our customers? It's if you're doing it for ourselves, the point is low, you know. Like, obviously we need to make sure our systems are optimized so we can get stuff done, but ultimately it needs to help our customers innovate.
Yeah.
And every startup should do that, right? Like, there's so much stuff. There's so much busy work you can do on a product, especially, where it's like, cool, look at me, I'm doing product tweaks. But really, is it moving the needle for the customer? You know, my personal reflection on this is I've written so many admin tools over my 20 years of development that nobody ever used. You know, like, they were complex things to configure things where, you know, the customer would call up in a year's time and go, hey, can you do this for me? I'm like, there's a tool I wrote. I'm built a tool to do that. And they're like, yeah, but I haven't used it for a year, and can you just do it for me? And I remember one of my startups, I refused to build admin tools and I ran everything via spreadsheets. I'm like, if you can send this spreadsheet to the customer and get them to fill it in, because it's a user interface construct they're really happy with, like, fill this data in and I will write a small script to parse it and stick it in the database and configure our system by that. Because the tools to write to, you know, to do a nice UI and all that kind of stuff was so many times I've built stuff that wasn't using it. And as a developer, writing something that doesn't have a customer was super frustrating for me.
This is very topical for me right now because we're sort of just investigating products or services that we could do. And I find that with this whole startup community, a lot of what is done just from fellow, you know, entrepreneurs, as you call it, is they think, oh, yeah, I've got this problem or I've got this idea and I'll go build this thing. Like, I'm intrigued to get your opinion on what are things that people can do to test out how much of a problem it is. And this is part of validation, obviously. But, like, as an example, I've just started reaching out to 4 or 5 friends with this specific product or service idea that we have and just trying to get them to say, yep, I would pay you for that service and I want them to get them to pay me directly and I'm going to do this service for you and then, you know, learn from there. And then if it comes to 3 months from now and we've got 20 people that are interested, maybe then we can start thinking about tech.
Yeah.
So I'm intrigued by what your opinion is on that. What can people do
in a
simplistic way?
Yeah, look, coming from having been a builder, having been a technical founder like 4 times, like the challenge – my view of the world is the challenge isn't the tech. Like, there's very, for most people's problems they're solving, the challenge isn't the tech. The challenge is whether or not anyone gives a shit. and that to me, again, because I can build the tech, I'm like, don't worry about it. I guarantee you we can build it. I can build anything. But building something no one cares about or no one uses is a waste of my time and your money. So I agree with you. If you can get someone to fill out a form and agree and pay you money to do something, then, yeah, if you can validate that you've got someone who's willing to hand over cash before you build anything, then always do that.
Yeah.
Like, it's you know, you want to reduce the mean time between figuring out whether it's a, you know, the risk is too high, right? So if you can reduce that down to a shorter period of time, which generally means not building a whole bunch of stuff, then good for you, you know.
What's the most intriguing way of validation you've seen a startup at a pitch night or you've met in person? Or
that's interesting. I haven't really thought about that. Yeah, again, my view of the world comes from a slightly technical one. So, you know, people releasing tech into it, because I quite often sell to other technologists, is you know, hustling at a conference or something to, you know, try and show off something a lot of the time. And because, well, I'm about to contradict myself. A lot of the people a lot of the startups I do are built by builders, so they can build something, a prototype or something that's quite superficial, but is enough to go, ooh, I have that problem, you know, and that problem costs me X amount of hours per week or cost my team X amount of hours a week. Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Where, you know, if you've got a more consumer facing problem or your customers are non-technical, then you can probably validate it in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, seeing people hustle out on the street or at a meetup or something like that is always interesting. I feel like it's hard to avoid biases, you know, of who you're talking to and why, but, you know, that's always an interesting thing.
Yeah.
But again, I don't, my space is not necessarily sort of things that people on Swanson Street would have a good answer to.
I feel like you've probably been pitched at events heaps of times with people just who haven't validated and have got this brand brilliant idea that they've gone at, like, had built. I think about some of these events that I used to go to and just the amount of money that people have spent.
Oh
yeah,
it's crazy. I mean, we all know that tech startups are the shiniest thing right now, which means that someone with a crazy idea might be able to go raise, you know, 150 grand from their rich uncle or something, and then throw it at an agency or something like that to come and sort of build a, you know, what effectively becomes a prototype, which then they use to go and try and validate the market. That's a lot of money to spend, and, you know, usually they're an unsophisticated founder, which means they've probably given away too much of the company for their 150K. You know, they've built something that's probably going to have to get thrown away, even if it does work. And they've probably screwed themselves for future rounds, even if it does go well. It's just the kind of thing. It's just brutal because it's everybody thinks the solution is the tech. The solution is not the tech. The solution is solving someone's pain, and there's ways you can do that in a relatively manual or smoke and mirrors, you know, kind of way.
I think that's a brilliant comment. The solution is the pain, not the tech. It's such a, there's so many instances, like I said, where I've seen that at events and just people have thrown away so much money. Yeah. I don't know. I wonder if there's any correlation with people succeeding in those sorts of instances where they've just gone and given away the money to agencies.
Yeah, I don't know. You can't put a broad statement and say it doesn't work, because I've got a portfolio company that did have its tech originally built by an agency, but that agency was a product agency that had a founder that cared deeply about, you know, the product, you know, and they were product people. So they weren't just like carte blanche building stuff they got told to build. They were actually involved heavily in the build and the understanding the customer, and therefore built, you know, the minimum amount of stuff to get done. So it doesn't not work, but unsophisticated founder, agency that will build anything for anyone, you know, and a check burning a hole in their bank account is probably not a great way to start a company.
Tell me, what's the greatest lesson you think you learned from founding your own companies over the years?
The lesson I've learned is that I'm good for certain parts of the company and certain roles in the company, and terrible at other stuff.
Okay.
So,
knowing your own competencies, basically.
Yeah. Look, I don't really do business as usual very well. When something's got to a point where it's like, cool, we've sort of figured it, cracked the nut, and it's, you know, cool, now we just need to do this, but more, I start to waver. Even the coding on the coding side of things, it's like, cool, now we know what we need to do, we just need to incrementally change things. I start to sort of go, well, you know, the hard stuff here is done. Let's go find something new. And that pattern is now obvious to me, nearly 40 years down the track and 25 years in business. I realize now that pattern has been consistent for a lot of things. It doesn't happen quickly, but it happens eventually. So, like, you know, I haven't gone through things super quickly unless there was an external reason. You know, we ran out of capital, we were self-funded for one. Another one, I joined an existing team. And I had some things to prove to myself that I then, you know, proved within 6 months and moved on to the next thing. Most things go for years, like they're not flash in the pan kind of stuff. But knowing what I know now about who I am and how I operate, then if I ever get into startup land again, I will make sure that things are geared up so that, you know, I can get in, get the stuff done, and then find a way to either find a new role within the company to do something else or to move on.
Knowing what you know now, and if you were to go back, say, 20 years or so, what would you change? What would you have done differently?
Yeah. I now know that, like, I always knew it, but now it's super concrete that, you know, the founding team is a killer, right? You know, you spend way more time with those people than you do your family a lot of the time. Having aligned goals there is really key. So having, I call them the big boy discussions up front, about what you're really good at, what your timelines are, you know, will hopefully help down the track. And you can codify this stuff in shareholders agreements and vesting agreements, and which I've done. But
just having the
conversation. So one of my startups was like, cool, we think we can get this thing we think we can flip this thing. We think we can get this to a point where we'll have enough customers and enough momentum that, you know, we can sell it to someone big. And, you know, that's a shitty way to start a startup, but nonetheless, it was what we did. It was at the time. There was, you know, there was less advice around saying that, you know, I hadn't heard Nikki from Blackbird say that if you're not doing your life's work, you know, we're not interested. As it turns out, one of the founders that one was doing his life's work, and I was like, well, come on now, we're ready to go. Let's flip this thing. And he's like, no, I want to run this thing. This is, I'm loving this and I really want to do this thing. So we had a diverging opinion.
Right.
And then I got out, you know, and that's okay. Like, and the one thing that I am proud of is that I can have a beer with every single one of my co-founders, every single one of my business partners I've had since I started business. And that's really important to me. Like, I think that, you know, it does get emotional. It gets emotionally charged and it gets tough. And some of the conversations can get really hard when you're talking about, hey, I'm going to leave now. You know, what is my equity? You know, what do we do with the equity? How does it work? You know, am I... Nobody wants to have a large equity holder who's not part of the business, especially early on in days, especially if you're raising capital that's going to make everything hard in the future. So how do we do this? You know, and having those big boy conversations without having to, you know, go to horrible legal lengths is you know, a sign of hopefully a sign of mature people.
Yeah. And when's the right time to do that? Literally at the time of founding?
Yeah, absolutely. It's far easier to put those things in place and when there's nothing really to speak of.
Yeah. There's no emotions involved.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential, but no, like, huh, you know, we're 3 years down. Yeah. What are we going to do now kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I had that conversation.
Yeah,
this is early in a few different startups.
You're not alone. Founder issues are, you know, as an angel investor, you know, I hear lots of other angel investors talking about, you know, they do mediation on startups all the time, you know, like, you know, having two founders telling them two different things, and quite often, you know, and I've done it for some of my portfolio companies, like, hey, you guys are both talking to me. Let's have this conversation. I have this thing that I talk about with my founders, and it's like, you've got to think about, there's you and there's your co-founder and there's the thing, and you really need to think about it as like a triangle. And it's like, there's things, and they've got to be like lines between each of the things, and they need to be in the same proportions or the right proportions. So, you know, you and your co-founder need to have a relationship, but you also have a relationship with this entity, and this entity has probably got shareholders and staff and all kinds of stuff. And quite often, the lines get disproportionate. You know, there's fat ones and thin ones, and the angst comes from not sort of getting the balance right.
Yeah.
You know, you can definitely say to each co-founder, like, what do you need from them? But ultimately, the thing is, like, what does the startup need from me? And then what do they need from us? How do we need to behave to make this thing successful? Most people default to how they need to behave so they feel good. And sometimes, you know, and I was to blame lots of times going, well, I want to do this. I'm like, well, the entity doesn't need that right now, or it can't sustain that right now, or, you know what, this shitty job over here needs to be done right now, go do that. And that's a tough conversation to have.
Yeah, but it's important nonetheless.
Yeah.
Who do you think are the most unique individuals in terms of angel investing here in, let's say, Australia?
Oh, to be quite frank, I don't have a whole bunch of people who I've got some guys who angel invest with me, but they're kind of part of a small syndicate that I work with, and they sort of follow on to a lot of the stuff I do. So they're definitely not out trying to find new things. You've interviewed Adrian Stone, and I've spent a lot of time with Adrian. I think he's got a really interesting view of the world. So the short answer to your question is I don't have a whole bunch of people I don't hang out with other angel investors very much. Yeah. So I don't really have a good view. Sorry.
No, that's fine. When we're talking about startups, who do you think then are sort of the most impressive teachers, I guess? People that everyone can learn from?
I'm not going to name any individuals, but there's a constant battle that we suffer here, and I think Australia suffers from it pretty poorly, which is the ability to be excited and talk up the stuff you're working on, and also stay humble. Like we've spoke, you know, tall poppy syndrome, and you know, it almost feels like people are afraid to be successful here for fear of being, for fear of you know, having someone, you know, crack the shits at them. I remember a mate of mine said he knows, you know, a guy who's a Ferrari dealer in Australia, and in Australia, Australia's the only place in the world where you get called a dickhead if you drive a Ferrari. Everywhere else is like, hey, that's cool. And here it's like, hey, you dickhead. Yeah. Someone throws a thing at you. You know, so, and that's tough for startup founders, because they want to, you know, they want to be able to talk about what they do and be proud of what they do. You know, there's always a little bit of humble Australian there, but it feels like to me that needle needs to move around a little bit more sometimes where, you know, celebrating someone who's taken a risk and had a win, or is on the way towards winning, I think is, and feeling like they've got a bunch of people behind them going, good on you, keep going. You know, we want to see you succeed is something, that I'd like to see more of.
Yeah. I think you're really spot on. I mean, obviously in America, they've got, you know, obviously it's a more capitalist driven society, but you know, the way that they speak, it's a free country. Everyone's here. They can do their own thing and achieve what they want to achieve. But I think the fair go mentality really defines a lot of Australia without people knowing, like indirectly. And I think about a lot of people have tried to bash Spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe you don't agree with it, but at least they're having a go, right? Mm-hmm. And it's intriguing just looking at, you know, even the comments in ads about what's his name? Just Paul. Blanked on his name.
Paul.
No, the founder of Atlassian, because he's in one of
Mike,
the ads.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mike, yeah. It's really enlightening, isn't it? You know, how people just bash other people for the sake of it.
Yeah, it's it actually drives me bonkers. You know, I think there's, you know, broadly two groups of people. You know, someone who sees something, you know, that's they either go, I want that. That's excellent. Good. Awesome. I'm going to go and figure out how to do that. Or they get like, no, that you know, that shit. And I think that there's too many of us are in that second category where it's like, yeah, someone's having a go. They're doing something different. You may not agree with it. You know, no one's forcing anybody to put their super in Spaceship, but there's a bunch of people who go, you know, like 9.5% of the money I earn is going somewhere. You know, a little bit of visibility would be nice. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I am a consumer of technology, and I do believe that this is going to, you know, help, you know, these tech companies are going to be big. So why wouldn't I, you know, allocate some of my future money towards it?
Yeah, I completely agree. When it comes to bad advice, what do you think is the worst advice being constantly dispensed around the startup space?
I don't know. The thing I get called upon to give two types of advice. One is startup advice and the other one is parenting advice because for some reason or other, our kids are a little bit older than a lot of people our age. But you need to treat them both the same, and that is you people will tell you everything from every extreme on every single measure. You need to let it wash over you and then just pluck the bits that that work for you, which, you know, it basically means that nobody's playbook is going to work for you. You know, if Mike and Scott from Atlassian gave you their playbook and you literally went, guys, here's everything I did from day zero to today, and you copied it, it wouldn't work.
Mm.
So it's like you can't.
You just got to be always improving.
I mean, and being self-aware enough to go, you know, I don't know what's going on right now. I need to sort of deep dive and figure some of this stuff out, or, you know, I'm going to ask for some advice, but then I'm going to go and try a few bits and pieces. It's like startup advice from people that have, you know, I actually feel like I'm not qualified. You know, I don't have any massive successes. I certainly don't have, you know, I've still got to do a job, still got to have a job because I haven't had a walk away success. So who am I qualified? Like, how am I qualified to give advice? I think my advice is important around co-founders and important around, you know, early stage startups and you're raising a little bit of capital. But there's a point where I just have to tap out. Like, it's a point where I don't have any experience doing that. And I will openly admit that to anyone who asks. And in fact, I'll give it to them as an asterisk before I start talking. I'm like, here's my experience. And you know, every day that goes by, that experience is getting further and further, smaller and smaller in a revision mirror. So it's probably less and less poignant on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So bad advice. Yeah, well, you know who would give bad advice? People that are consultants and people that are trying to help you raise money and get paid for it in the meantime. You know, I help lots of companies raise money. I generally either participate like every other investor and put money in at RRP, or, you know, if you're going to take advisor shares, if they're going to be advisory shares, then take it with future looking stuff, you know, with a vesting agreement attached to it. You know, that's the best you can do. So, you know, I heard this from start this morning that, you know, someone helped raise the money and they got 7% of the company afterward.
Oh my God.
I'm like, 7%, that's I've done whole rounds that are that size, you know, like not just the advisor, that's and then the new capital came in. Wow. And I'm like, that's gonna make your life difficult in the future.
Yeah. It's definitely a coach killer, isn't it? That sort of stuff.
Yeah, and you know, look, it's difficult because lots of people are trying this for the first time. We don't have, I don't think we have a really deep pool of founders that have sort of started, had a beginning, middle, and end. So we don't have a bunch of people walking the streets going, oh yeah, there's this one time I raised $2 million and then, you know, it went out and it failed and then here I am again going it. You know, there's a lot of people that are in play, you know, that have their capital and off they go. There's a lot of deeply experienced and, you know, long-term founders that wrote the first dot-com bubble that are all now, you know, in VC land and, you know, they're at that kind of level. But there isn't a lot of people who are just sort of going around going, oh, yeah, I've been through this process one or two times before and let me tell you how I did it or let me tell you what's, you know, what's relevant for raising or, you know, whatever right now.
Yeah. I want to switch into some faster questions.
Sure.
As we head out with our time. Do you have a morning ritual?
Yeah, I get up and I go for a run. I go for an extremely boring run. I just do laps on my block. Because I'm not there to look at the scenery. I'm there to listen to podcasts and run around the block, and it's easy to measure. You can do 5Ks and that's that. Come back, have a cold shower, which is brutal in the winter, but nonetheless, and then generally get on my bike and ride to work.
Okay.
By the time I'm leaving, family's up and at it, but they're all pretty self-sufficient nowadays. So, yeah, that's my morning routine.
And exercise, is it just running and riding or do you do weights or anything
like that? No, I don't do anything else at this stage. And even that is even those things haven't necessarily been consistent. I've done other stuff in the past, but I find this is there's a very low barrier to going running. Even if it's raining or it's cold, you can still do it. You just need to HTFU and do it. Riding to work is easy and it's better than a tram. It's just faster. The downside is I lose a little bit of time for listening to podcasts or reading because I'm riding.
Yeah. Do you have anything that you use to reduce stress or I guess take your mind away from life, so to speak?
No, nothing special. I do like to, you know, I don't watch like free-to-air TV, but, you know, my wife and I do enjoy watching, you know, some TV series on the couch before bed at night once the kids have gone to bed. But yeah, no, just making sure I get that exercise done in the morning has such an impact at the day, but yeah, no, nothing for switching off besides that.
When it comes to TV, I know you're a fan of Billions.
Yeah. there's, Those kind of you know, we'll call them semi-realistic dramas, Suits, Billions, that kind of stuff where it's like, I wonder whether this shit actually happens. You know, like, yeah. Or it probably doesn't happen like this, but it's probably not too far removed from reality. And it just fascinates me that the personalities and the kind of people you need to, you know, person you need to be to pull that shit off. You know, I look at it and go, that's not me, I don't think.
It's an interesting show. I'd recommend anyone to check it out. Is there any other TV shows that you're like sort of religiously watching these days?
No, the only thing is we don't put screens on as I said, throughout the week with the kids. But we've been enjoying watching Seinfeld from scratch with the kids. You know, for us, it's like furniture. You know, you can quote most. You know, there's a quote in every single episode, but the kids think it's hilarious. And and some of it's quite you know, some of it's quite raw and it's very 90s.
Do they have a favourite character at the moment?
I don't think so. I think they just chuckle along, and whether or not a whole bunch of stuff goes over their head or not, I don't know. But you know, it's funny thinking about us as parents. You know, back then, you know, in a similar kind of age, I would have been watching Seinfeld and The Simpsons in real time on free to air TV, and now we're watching it. Yeah, now we're watching it. You know, at nighttime sometimes. You know, on demand.
Yeah,
it's exact same content, just time shifted 20 years down the line.
Isn't that fascinating? I always. That's why I love businesses like Disney. You know, they are able to take, like, look at Beauty and the Beast. They're able to take a piece of content that was made. Yeah. God knows how long ago, yeah. And just recycle it in different ways on in different formats.
Yeah,
and still make money from it.
Yeah, it's you know, timeless content.
Do you, if you were to do a TED talk on a topic outside of tech, startups, venture capital, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah,
what would it be on?
I've been really fascinated lately with trying to understand. It's slightly tangential to the tech stuff, but, you know, listening to someone like Elon Musk talk about, you know, neural interfaces and are we in a simulation and that kind of stuff, and just letting my mind wonder whether or not that is true.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to do a dive on that and figure out and throw some hypothesis around that.
Well, he really took that from that book, Superintelligence, and I've read the excerpt or the chapter many a times. I mean, to me, it just seems like it seems mathematically probable. I mean, the alternatives are what? That we're either not in a simulation, therefore that's a problem because life could just stop at any moment. But there was another component to that. It's sort of a three-sided probability.
Yeah, it just fascinates me. It's just like I don't have a strong opinion on it. I don't have that, but I don't know, every now and then when I'm running or it's quiet or something, I'm like, it'd be really interesting if sometimes, like the way I describe it, it feels like to me sometimes that we're in a SimCity 2000 game that some pimply teenager let run over the weekend.
Yeah.
And stuff's just going off the tracks. He comes back and Godzilla's walked through the middle of shit because he wasn't paying attention.
I always find myself every now and then just thinking about it, you know, like imagine what that person, because you always go back to thinking about The Sims, right? Imagine what that, who is that thing if it's true, like, and what are they thinking about my life?
Yeah.
It'd be quite fascinating.
The just speaking of the kids, they, you know, we kind of watch a movie on Sunday night or something like that, and we've watched Men in Black recently, you know, and that the title film where they just keep zooming out and out and out and out and out and out and out, and the whole thing's just an alien playing marbles with planets, you know. It's like like how far do you need to zoom out before it all sort of makes sense again?
Yeah. Fuck, it really plays with your mind. What do you think you're most proud of?
I mentioned it before, I'll say it again, you know, having run multiple businesses with, you know, beginnings, middles and ends, I think they're having, you know, being able to have a beer with every one of my business partners and knowing that, you know, at the time there was tough decisions made, but afterwards it was like, cool, well, and everyone's sort of getting on with it. Like, I'm really proud of that on a business level. On a personal level, you know, I love my kids. They're, you know, they're easygoing, you know, smart boys who seem to be dealing with the world in a really great way. I'm really proud of my wife and our relationship, you know, 15 years, 16 years married this year. And, you know, she is doing some really cool stuff, and I'm, you know, she's my biggest investor, like, and, you know, make it very clear that, you know, all our investments are, and they're not my investments, they're our investments. And,
yeah. And
you know, she's on the line for as much as I am. So, you know, she's had to have nerves of steel and back me as I'm going through my tumultuous, you know, startup phase, and then go, by the way, honey, I want to spend some of our money on other people doing the same shit. And she's like, are you serious? Okay, well, you know, tell me what we're going to do, and off we go.
Mm. What is playing on your playlist right now?
So 2 weeks ago, I sat down with Duncan Anderson, who is the founder of a company called Ed Rollo, one of the Blackbird portfolio companies. And this guy is a just a force of nature. He listens to podcasts at 5x the speed, which is just mind-blowing. But he's put together a podcast list of curated podcast episodes.
Okay.
So called Amazing Podcasts. And I've been listening to those flat stick lately. So on a information level, it's those podcasts and Dead Mouse for when I'm exercising. Upbeat tempo makes me go faster.
Yeah. So that podcast that you were talking about, is it that they're just literally listening to podcasts and then talking about what they're about?
No, he's listening to podcasts. He's listening to a lot of podcasts. And then he's got his own podcast, which is just episodes from other podcasts that he sort of links to. So it's a curated list of episodes from other podcasts that you listen to flat stick.
Yeah.
And I can only do 2x, and even then I have to slow it down a little bit because it takes a while to get going fast.
Wow. What is something that a lot of people disagree with you on but that you know is quite true? This is the old Peter Thiel question.
Yeah, you sent me this question 2 days ago, and I've been thinking about it ever since.
Like, what seems obvious to you, but not to a lot of people? Like, you know, I think about when people sit down at dinner with a group of friends, and they say something, and people are like, "Ah," but they sort of don't really take it on board, and maybe it, you know, hits them later on.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. I think it's almost impossible to get everything you need out of one single relationship. And I'm talking just on an interesting level. You know, like, you know, time goes by and a whole bunch of people come in and out of your life. So, you know, having a conversation spread across multiple people is just fascinates me. It's like and as relationships get longer, you know, how they operate changes, and having deep discussions with on weird things doesn't always work that way. So so to answer your question, I think that being open to have all kinds of, you know, new conversations with new people is something, like, you see a lot of people who's over time, it's hard to meet new people, right? It's hard to learn new shit from new people because you just sort of, everything sort of shrinks down and sort of doesn't work as frequently as you might expect. So, you know, I speak to new startup founders and new thing all the time and try and ask the same similar questions you're asking me right now and try and get some differing points of the view on the world. You know, it's always comfortable to come back to your friends and your family and have those conversations that have long running threads that go for years. But to, you know, find someone new to have a conversation with, I think is something that a lot of people are like, "Oh yeah, I don't know. I haven't sort of met anyone new lately. I haven't really sort of had any new, you know, oh, maybe that's something I should entertain."
That's a good point. Do you think that you've made, or what's an investment you've made that could be time, money, energy, or any other resource that has been the most worthwhile, do you think? And I say it doesn't have to be time because – sorry, it doesn't have to be money because it could have been something – a little change that you made in your life over the last few years that has had the greatest impact.
Yeah. For me, I have this really strong relationship with sleep. I sleep a lot. Like, I don't stay up late and I get up early. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't always been that way. You know, when I was running startups and when I was writing code, it's quite easy to – get to 2 o'clock in the morning and it's like, "Oh crap, I got to go to sleep," and, you know, and get up. And especially with the family, you know, they're up early because they're kids. So yeah, I think just shutting down at a reasonable time, 10:30 at night, and be back up again at 6 o'clock in the morning or thereabouts to sort of get going again. And, you know, that allows you to not have that "I didn't have time." Like, it's like, and just sort of realizing that the beginning of the day is the highest chance of having the lowest chance of having an interruption. So if you got to get that stuff done, get it done then, you know, thinking, so yeah, my relationship with sleep and time, which hasn't always been the way. It's funny, I used to give my dad so much grief, right? Like he was so regimented. And he'd get up at the same time every morning and get ready and go to work because he used to commute an hour into town. And and when my brother at 15 got an apprenticeship, he'd sort of get up early as well and get in his way and get in the shower, and he'd just sort of stand there and go, "Oh, I've got to wait for the shower now." He didn't want to change his routine around. And I'd give him so much grief about it, and now I've got an appreciation for that. Like, you just get up and you do your thing. You don't have to think too hard about it, and you've exercised, and you've sort of gotten all that boring stuff out of the way, so that when you sit down and you turn on, to do work or to deal with whatever, then you sort of got this clean slate. That's and all the stuff that as I enter into my 40s, I'm like, this is not optional anymore, right? I can't just sit around on the computer all day long because it's going to be really unhealthy.
When did you make that decision?
It was only a year or two ago. Like, it's only relatively recently.
Yeah.
Before, it was just a bit ad hoc. Like, I've always resisted, being regimented, and I think, looking at my dad laughing at that, working at Macca's and that was all, it's all about, doing the same thing over and over again, and I've resisted terribly to doing the same thing over and over again.
Well, yeah, it's funny because that's the product or service that we're investigating now, because I find that for 8 years I had really bad anxiety and a relationship with sleep, because I just wasn't sleeping well, wasn't dealing with stress well, all that sort of stuff. And I just find that a lot of people just don't, that they don't implement it well and view it as its own thing, like having certain steps to prime your body for that. And it's very intriguing when you make those changes, how much it affects your mood, your life, everything.
Yeah.
The quality of sleep is incredibly important as well.
Yep.
Are there any books that you'd recommend to anyone at all?
I listened to two audiobooks lately. They were Ryan Holiday's The Obstacle is the Way.
Oh, yeah.
And the other one. The other one.
The Ego is the Enemy?
They're the ones.
Yeah.
And The Ego is the Enemy was really good, you're going to be in one of three states, which is, aspiring, succeeding, or failing. And I look at that, and I that book I read, and talking about the Stoics and, being self-aware of that stuff and when to turn the ego up and when to turn it down and when to, that kind of stuff is something that I find fascinating. I find I'm not sure people are self-aware enough sometimes to know when to dial it up and dial it down.
If you could have a billboard anywhere in the world, where would it be and what would it say?
Location-wise, I don't have anywhere specific, but my favorite saying at the moment, it's something that I've just sort of not come across lately, but it's really resonated, is what's next? ? one of my favorite series of shows we used to watch for a long time was The West Wing, and Jed Bartlett was, is known for sort of efficient meeting runnings and just what's next. And for me, that statement is sort of kind of core to who I am. And it's not necessarily saying what's next in a, I need to move on from this thing. But just, what's next? And for me at the moment, it's really focusing on my new role and helping, startups here in Melbourne. And that's what's next for me. But sometimes it's what's next, whatever. So, yeah, if I've got the balls to go through with it, I'll be getting a tattoo for my 40th birthday. That says what's next.
Well, that is what's next.
You're exactly right, yeah.
Well, look, I like that. That's a good way to end it, I think, what's next. And look, Matt, I really appreciate your time. If people were to contact you, follow you on social media, what are sort of the platforms that you're on?
Yeah, Twitter's probably the main one. Just at Matt Allen. That's the main one I work on. I've been doing LinkedIn stuff lately, but that's boring.
it's so boring.
My website's at matter.io, and contact details are on there.
Cool. Well, appreciate your time. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Thank you for making it this far. We really do hope you enjoyed this episode. Make sure, as I said at the start, leave us a review. We always appreciate feedback and thoughts on each episode. You can head to neural.com/podcast and join the 90% of our listeners with priority access. So if you want all the show notes and when an episode is released first, that'll be available to you. Don't forget to like us on Facebook or Twitter. It's just @Neural. Until next episode, thanks for listening.